This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2022, held at Faith Builders on August 2 through 5.
I'm here this afternoon for our third session with Wholesome on Wholesome Living for Effective Teaching. And we have discussed or talked about cultivating spiritual virtues and values. In session one, session two, essential social life habits that stabilize and energize. And this afternoon, quite a bit more practical in many ways. Title here being Physical Health, Preparing for the Rigors of Teaching. And I added to that, just to expand it a little bit, Health, Wealth, and Reality. So, we'll kind of be using some of that terminology here as we think about wholesome living for effective teaching. Let's do pray together before we begin. Father, I want to thank you for your goodness and your grace. And once again, just marvel at how it is that you raise up teachers across the land for our communities. Lord, I'm blessed by the young ladies who step forward and who take their place and bravely and courageously walk into classrooms and teach. I thank you for young men who do similarly, and older men and older ladies who stay in the saddle longer. Lord, I'm blessed, and our communities are blessed, and I pray that you would help each one present here today to one more time just think about the awesome responsibility, but also to think about the resources that you have available, endless resources. And we call upon you this afternoon, even in this time that we share together, to walk with us, teach us, open our hearts, our eyes, our ears to you. And I pray it in Jesus. Amen. I want to begin by just putting two sketches here on the board. To illustrate something that I have been talking about in many ways, and today will be kind of a theme that runs here throughout this discussion on health, wealth, and reality. So the first one is, if you remember that I'm a mechanic, and I spoke to you about reservoirs and hydraulics just a little bit. And just want to point out a couple of things that might be useful here in our understandings. So here's a tank, here's input coming into the tank, into the reservoir, and I have actually strategically located the outputs just for a particular reason. I didn't do real well with my drawing here, but what I intend to show you and what I will be showing you consistently or talking about, input must exceed output. Inflow must exceed outflow. Now, there's more to this little diagram than what meets the eye. You'll notice, first of all, that I don't have the any of the outflows clear at the bottom. Why not? Well, you never want this tank to run empty. Okay, you always, it will not get any emptier than that. Okay, because the output is, the lowest output is higher and off the bottom. A second thing to note is this, in hydraulics, we call this a priority system. Why do we call it a priority system? Well, if the level is up here where it's supposed to be and it begins to drop, this is the first one that's out of oil. Do you see that? And this one still has oil. You might guess. Well, I'll let you guess just for fun. In hydraulics and in mechanical engineering, what component must run on the tractor or on the automobile or whatever it is? You better be able to steer, right? You better have that power steering working, okay? So that one's got to run. It's essential. Now, there's some lessons here. So I'm not just having fun. Well, I am having fun with the hydraulics thing a little bit. But there's a great lesson in what I'm talking about here. Remember, first, input always must exceed output. Second of all, what you see in here is built into good systems. Even if it's working, that input is ahead of output. There are priorities. There's some systems that have to run. Other ones, if they shut down, it's okay. Let them shut down. You can recover from that, but some are essential. So in some ways, I want you to be thinking as we talk about some of these questions, I'd make application to your own experience. What has to keep going? What could you actually, if you do run out of fuel, it could shut down and it wouldn't be disaster. So that second diagram I want to point out to you, very, very simple one, looks like this. This is a page in a book, and this is the margin. As I speak to you, I am in the process of reading through Martyr's Mirror, I hope, lid to lid for the first time. I've read in it before, but I've never read it from front to back. And so I'm doing that. Well, I'm doing it online. And the problem with the online, at least the online program that I'm using currently, is it has no margin on the pages. So it's all the way out. It's irritating. When you read, at least for me, when I read a book that doesn't have enough margin, something doesn't feel right. Well, life is like that. Okay, and so the two models here that I want you just to keep in the background of, or metaphors here, in the background of the discussion is input-output model and the margin model. Life goes a whole lot better, no matter if you're teaching or what you're doing, if there's margin. And listen, I've taught school longer than most of you, and I'll confess to you that I spent way too much of my life and still am too often in this category where there's no margin. That's when you're about ready to go off the edge of the paper, when you don't have any margin, okay? So those two things I want you to be thinking about as we look into or walk through some of our notes here. So to begin with, again, a diagram similar to what you saw yesterday, a three-part diagram, and you see at the top of your paper there, health, wealth, and reality, wholeness or holiness. Actually, the two words are related to each other. So whole or complete, and the word holiness speaks to the same issue, and that is good balance throughout one's life. And experience. And interestingly enough, I put these three up here. These are the three categories I'm going to break this out into to begin with, particularly the health section there. So physical health, mental health, and emotional health. On the physical health issue, I'm going to come back to it here in just a moment, but just a comment or so there. It's fascinating in the Old Testament how fastidious the Israelites were about this and the instructions that God gave to them about how the body was to be taken care of. I mean, you read some of those details and it's like, look, bathe, get yourself ready here at Sinai. We're going to be in the presence of the Lord tomorrow. Wash yourself. And there's details given in there. And of course, as you well know, the priest, you weren't permitted to be a priest if there were any blemishes or significant flaws or any such thing. That was a problem. You couldn't be a priest. I am so glad that in the New Testament era, this is not something that we focus on. I couldn't have joined the Air Force if I wanted to. I was an airplane pilot. I don't have a license anymore. But I could have never joined the Air Force, even if I did not have the parameters I put around my life to begin with. Well, I'm too short. I forget what, well, maybe they changed the rules, I don't know, but they used to have rules, you have to be so tall, and you couldn't be more than so. Anyway, lots of emphasis there over the years. Just one story leading into the mental health and emotional health sectors here. So, remember, I lived my life without any margin for way too many years. Still a little bit that way, but back when we had, I believe we had four children, and the third and fourth child, they're twins. I'm sorry, we had five. So two, then twins, then another child, and I was involved in a prison ministry in Chambersburg, along with John D. Martin and a number of other people there, and we occasionally had people come live with us. I showed you a picture of Sheila. She is a remarkable lady, believe me. Some of the things that I put her through is unbelievable. And I've stated this publicly all over the place, and I'll say it again. If I have had success in my public ministry, at least 51% of it belongs to Sheila. She's a sturdy lady, as you'll hear here. So she was 2 weeks, I'm sorry. She was 2 weeks from having her fifth child, and I had a man lined up to come and live with us. And so he actually lived with some of our friends until Sheila had Kyle, the brother here, who's my son, who's teaching here in the split sessions, was born just a week before John Frumkin came and lived with us. The issue, John Frumkin was bipolar. I did not actually know it clearly at the time we opened our doors to him. But while I was in for a journey, and we were in for a journey like you wouldn't believe, this man had hair down to his shoulders, an intelligent man. When he was doing well, just a wonderful person to be around and enjoy and appreciate and all of that. But if you know anything about bipolar, boy, it can go all kinds of different directions. And so John is there, and I'm still bewildered by how this would work. Because, as you know, probably know, bipolar is, here's the median line, and most people have some ups and downs, you know, some days in which we're, I don't know, just a little bit on the downside, and then some days when we're on the upside, but bipolar is extreme swings in up and down. And John would go, I don't know, he would get up there on the high spot, and when he did, he'd lose reality. I mean, I remember him coming home from work, sitting down for supper. I'd come home from school, and he'd announce, "Melvin, I'm going to own all the banks in Chambersburg by the end of this month." And I'd be like, "Yeah." And he'd say, "You doubt my integrity." And I'd say, "Well, yeah, I do." And he said, "I'll show you." It took me a little while to figure out he actually believed that he was going to be able to pull this off. Well, without going into details, of course, it wouldn't be all that long to be clear down in the trough somewhere and severe issues and problems back in prison or something along that line. Here's what amazed me, what I still don't know what to make of. He was with us long enough, I could make the prediction. If you gave him a chemical when he was in extreme depression, right? If you gave him a chemical, it would begin to correct that, but he'd had total personality change. No interest in spiritual things whatsoever and all that. He'd start out of that trough and come back up close to the center line on that sine wave, about that center line, and he would just be the most wonderful person to be around ever. He's on his drug. Spiritual, so forth and so on. And I would say to Sheila, I'd say, "Well, pay attention here." Because he would cross that line, and after a while he would start to say things. He would just mention a few things, and I could tell he was coming up to the top here somewhere, and reality was disappearing. And I'd say, "John, he's quit taking his chemical." And spirituality would blossom out. It would go really big. I could I still am bewildered and frustrated by how that chemical would push him around, not only on his attitude and mood, but just his spiritual aptitude. He knew his Bible like everything. It was an intelligent man, but I really enjoyed talking with him. But boy, that drug would push him one way or the other. Okay, I'm only saying that to say, okay, so mental health, emotional health, you probably, all of us likely have had enough experience, maybe personally, but perhaps know people who struggle in this area. Of course, that's not going to be my point to you. My point is going to be to you when we talk about those as well. How do you maintain some balance here? How do you keep yourself put together, even if you are normal, when it feels like your world's falling apart? So I do want to touch on those. But just tell you up front, I've had enough experience across the range as a pastor and so on to recognize that, wow, some of these issues are not very easy to reckon with at all. But we'll let that lay for the time being. These three are interactive, just to be sure that you understand that. I have the arrows pointing both directions. Why? Well, listen, physical health matters. Okay, I don't mind telling you just a little bit of my own history here. You can see I'm not a big fellow. I had a history of Crohn's disease. I don't know if you've ever heard of that or not, but it's not any fun. Let's just say it this way, it's excessive diarrhea, but it can get really bad, okay? And I can tell you that when I get sick, when I feel that Crohn's disease kind of wanting to creep up, it's a little bit like apparently Paul's thorn in the flesh. It just sort of, it bugs me. You know, it gets at me on occasion. Well, I'm grumpier. I'm more difficult to, I don't have the energy that I typically have. Physical health matters. And you need to pay attention here. Okay, we'll expand on that a little bit more. It helps us to maintain balance in mental health, emotional health, and so forth and so on. And that's where I'm going to start here in just a moment, talking about that in the recognition that it's an important point. So leaving that and just moving forward, this is a little off to the side, but I offer it to you for what it's worth. I thought I would. So this is called the Greek Trivium. It doesn't exactly map onto my first slide there, but it's worth thinking about a little bit. So the trivium here is the logos, the ethos, and the pathos is the way the Greeks talked about it. And again, don't want to spend much time with it, but just point out to you that if you're thinking about life, so the logos, they said, or that's, as you probably know, John in the Gospel of John, the logos is spoken of, and it's translated word. In the beginning was the word, and the word was with God, and so forth. You can see the word logic there. So word, worldview, goal, internal consistency. This is a little bit along the line of holiness, and that is my worldview, what I actually see, feel, and perceive. Is it consistent? Okay, and say more about that when we get to mine. Ethos is, you can see the word ethic there, character, good and evil. Interestingly enough, pathos is the word passion, it's not the word passion, but it brings that idea up, and that is, what does somebody really care about? So you could think a little bit of the logos as one's mind, the ethos of how it's worked out, and the pathos as emotional health. Don't make too much of that diagram. I just thought I would at least put it up here. You can write some of that in if you care to. It's a fascinating way of thinking about things. You probably have heard me reference this enough in the three times we've been together. I'd like to know where the source of vision, values, and passion is at. And I'd like to know how to pass that on to future generations. But that's a little bit for fun there. What we want to do then is go ahead and take a look, think a little bit about physical health. By the way, I'm not going to be doing two sessions today. I doubt it will take us an hour and a half to walk through the material here and think about things, but we'll see. So, physical health. Pay attention to rest, sleep, awake rhythms. This is basically straight from my heart to mind. These are the things that I've learned over the years that have been very, very valuable. Ladies and gentlemen, there is nothing holy about staying up till 2 o'clock, working on lessons and trying to get everything put in place for the next day, and then getting back up at 6 o'clock and you're dragging around and you can't keep your mind on what's happening, and everything is sort of, your emotions might even be a little weak. There's nothing holy about that at all. Think about it, wholesome and complete. Okay, and so listen, our bodies were made in such a fashion, and they happen to need rest. Notice I actually make a difference between rest and sleep, okay? Because rest means being able to rejuvenate, inputs coming in, okay, rather than outputs going out, and sleep. Regularity here. I'd hate to map myself onto other people. In fact, I don't think I should. I realize people are different. Very, very much aware of that. But you pay attention to your rhythms and keep that rhythm. Okay? There's a time for deviation. For sure. There's a time to stay up until 1 o'clock. I want to be sure to let you know that. But I think in terms of long term, what is the practice? What is actually happening over time? I don't mind telling you what my regular schedule is. 9:30, 10 o'clock, probably no later than 10:30, I'm in bed. And I'm typically up by 5 o'clock in the morning. I'm a morning person, and so I might even get up at 4 if I feel like I need to or whatever. Sometimes I'm old enough now, I get awake at 4 sometimes, so I just get up, because why lay there and do nothing? And so I get up and that's just pretty. So to this day, I grew up on a dairy farm, and so that was a schedule that kind of worked its way into my psyche way back then. And so today it frustrates my wife. She didn't grow up on a farm, and that lady can sleep. But when it hits 5 o'clock, I'm finished. I mean, I can't sleep if I had to. Now, it's like, well, I might as well get up because I can't sleep anyway. No, I want you to know that she's regular in her getting up, but then she doesn't get up at 5. She gets up more like 6:30 or 7 o'clock or something along that line. But she sleeps well, a lot better than I do, for that matter. I think it's a gift. I honor her for it. For me, at 5 o'clock, I'm up. But rhythms work for you. The sporadic, just one night it's late, the next night it's not, and 3 nights later it's late again, and you never know when you're going to bed and when you're not. I would urge you to consider finding some kind of rhythm that actually works and fits your biologic rhythms. So for years, 6 hours of sleep were enough for me. No more. I do need more sleep than that now. Well, just be sensible, Melvin. If 6 hours of sleep wear you down and life has changed and you're now 66 and you're not 35, well, then make the adjustment, but let that rhythm settle in and become your rhythm. So I just know that's what I need on average. And so I'm closer to 7 hours now than I would have been at one time. Pay attention to rest, sleep, waking hours. And find your rhythms and stay in them. Now, again, don't make that into a law. Short-term deviation is likely necessary and does not violate what I'm talking about. It's the long-term thing that will catch up to you and will do you in. It's probably why I came down with Crohn's at 32 years of age. It's because I'm a pusher. Where's the next thing to do? And as soon as I have a little space, I would fill it up with something else. This is just not a good idea. No margin. I kept filling it up. Don't do it. Pay attention to rest, sleep, and awake rhythms. Be thoughtful about a diet that fits your work and activities. I always hesitate to say much here because I certainly understand the different metabolisms we have and so forth and so on. But obviously, keeping weight down is a good idea, health-wise, energy-wise, and so forth and so on. But I'm thinking even broader than that. Listen, your life, most of your lives, are probably more sedentary than what even the life was that I grew up in, and the life that my father had was, listen, they could eat pig fat. Because before lunchtime, they had worked it all off anyway. It didn't settle down into their veins. I don't say that it never did. I'm just saying that in general, hardworking people do need a little bit more input somewhere to keep them going. And the difficulty is if you were that, and then you move to a more sedentary life and you don't adjust that diet, something's going to happen that you don't want to happen. So that's just one example in what I mean by be thoughtful about diet that fits your work and activities. The modern diet is quite different. My father would have never heard of some of the stuff that my wife makes. I can't even hardly say the names of that stuff from all over God's creation and this country and that country and so on. And just, I kind of like that food, and and some of it is very healthy and so forth and so on. So I'm all for it, but be thoughtful there. And the third point here is exercise regularly. And it's funny how people will want to gravitate toward things toward fancy equipment, particularly fellows, I suppose. I don't know about the gals. And some even take out a gym. They go to the gym my brother-in-laws do that all the time. You know what? My rule of thumb is I want to have very, very active, healthy exercises that require almost no equipment, or very, very little equipment, not expensive. The one that comes to mind, and the one that I do regularly, is I do some long distance running. Believe it or not, this is the craziest thing. I can't help but tell you this story. So Crohn's came, I administrated here at the school up until 2013. Crohn's returned then, and that's when I stepped out and said, look, let somebody else do this job. So for a couple of years, I wrestled with it again. That 45th anniversary, we went to Prince Edward Island. And my sons do a little bit of long distance running. And they said to me, they said, Dad, you should try long distance running. Well, the second time I got Crohn's disease, I had rather severe arthritis-like pain in my hips. And they said to me, Dad, you should try long distance running. You used to do that when you were young. Why don't you? Oh, I said, I'd die. Well, anyway, we're on our way to Prince Edward Island, 45th anniversary. And Sheila says to me, you realize, my dear husband, that this is the first time that we have gone away for 2 weeks that you did not have a speaking engagement or something you had to do or this or that. You realize this is the first time. I said, that's not true. But then I couldn't think of any. So anyway, we get up there to Prince Edward Island, and we have this nice little cabin, and I got up a beautiful sunshine end of May. I give you Canadians one thing, that was one of the best 2 weeks I've spent in my life. It was fantastic. Got up in the morning, I said to Sheila, I said, you know what? The boys say that I should try a little bit of running, and I mean, what would it hurt if I come back in here and collapse and I'm in bed for the next 3 days? Well, we're here anyway, so I suppose that would be okay. So I go out and I trot around for, I don't know, maybe a mile or so, and I got up the next morning, and don't you know, I felt a little better than I did the day before. And I'm like, well, not strange. And long story short, the more I ran and the longer I ran, the better I felt. Now, that was a good thing. You did not hear me say that running will fix everything under the sun. You know how we do when we get some notion in our mind. These are called, it's called quackery. So we have the notion that, okay, if that's what happened, that'll fix it for everybody. Now, you didn't hear me say that, but it did for me. And so I just kept at it. And so then when I turned 60 years old, my sons and I ran a half marathon. And I'm like, how did that happen? Well, it just trying to make sense of where I was at, what my health issues were, and what actually worked. And incidentally, my doctor said, probably what's happening is you're foolish enough to put your body under extreme duress. And when you put it under extreme duress, it produces its own natural anti-inflammatory that chemicals, and Crohn's is inflammatory. He said, well, very likely you're just simply stimulating your body enough that it's dumping enough of that into your system to knock it back. Okay. Forget my story, but remember to exercise regularly and to find something that is simple you can do. See, the thing about running that I like is I can get up in the morning. If I want to run for an hour, I can get up at 4:30. But just run with a flashlight. I don't run along the road. If any of you come up to the Beaver Pond, you'll see where I run. Do some running back around there, this kind of thing. I don't get Sheila awake. I can just crawl out of bed and get my stuff on and run around there, and I don't bother anybody, and it didn't cost me anything. I didn't have to, no equipment needed, and so forth and so on. That's the kind of thing that you want to do, because I tell you what, the more complicated it is, the less likely you'll do it. So you want to take these simple things, you want to take the complication out of it. You want to make it simple, but you want to make it effective. So running for me is very effective. For somebody else, it might be something else that is really, really quite effective. But I would really encourage you as a teacher, you spend a lot of time, you spend a lot of people time, and there's a lot of drain. And oh, incidentally, the side benefit for running for me is also is if I'm really upset, then I just run faster. And that kind of has a way of sort of, I don't know, it works some things out on me along the way. So I know I'm bragging up running a bit, but don't hear me being stuck on it. Just hear me saying that I find it to be a really, really good thing. I probably should stop here. Some ideas that you have here on any of this, taking care of your body. I'm sure you have some, but we'll let it at that. Shifting our attention a bit here now to mental health. And I make a difference between mental health and emotional health. Back, if you remember the original slide, well, you have it there. I have heart beside emotional health. And beside mental health, I have mind. A couple verses here. They're on your paper there. I know they're a little small, smaller than what old people can read, but you probably can read them. Jesus said unto him, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind, your intellectual power and capacity. Trust in the Lord with all thine heart and lean not unto thine own understanding. A warning against thinking ourselves so smart. You know this very well. Thirdly, for God hath not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. Listen, I quote that verse to myself. I'm a pastor and I'm a teacher, and I've been a principal, I've been an administrator, and I know those days when there's a lot of pressure on, and fear wants to grow in one's heart. I'd stop and say, but God hath not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. Use it. Brother Melvin, use it. I say that to myself. And then I ask the Lord to help me to use it. another one. Wherefore, gird up the loins of your mind. Be sober in hope to the end for the grace that is to be brought unto you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So gather it together. We sometimes say, Come on, get it together. Okay, and what do we mean? Make sense of what's going on in there. And be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind. This is a fascinating verse if you think about it. So, and it goes on to say that you may prove, this is a logical thing, what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Transformation has something to do with more than just the heart. It says renew it by the renewal of the mind. Remember logos, worldview. It's not my subject here, and I'm trying to be careful not to jump off into that. But so the renewal of the mind is actually taking the parts and the pieces that are frayed and are out all over the place and getting them organized in such a fashion that they make logical sense. And then being able to communicate that as well. So, yes, just some very powerful verses there that are helpful in that sense. The next slide that you have is one that I just use for my life and leadership for men, and I have it here just for fun. You know what? I thought I might be interested in becoming a surgeon. And so I kind of like biology, and I've studied it a little bit, not a whole lot. But fascinating to me, you can read about these early experiments that were done when they would do brain surgery. They'd touch certain parts of the brain, the person would just start to laugh. Touch another part of the brain, and they would go into some other mood. And so they soon learned that somewhere deep in our brain are the pathways that create the attitudes and our responses and so forth and so on. I'm of the persuasion that we lay those pathways down early in life, and as they get laid down one by one and the connections get made, they create the person that I am and the responses I have. And it particularly my loves. You see that heart there, the things that I really like. But again, I don't want to jump off track here, but it's when I'm talking to young men, I really get on this one and say, you pay attention here. Young ladies too, pay attention here, because the younger you are, the easier it is to lay down those pathways. And the older you get, the more difficult it is to unravel them, if you find that need to unravel them and make them get those pathways laid out differently. So one wants to work it out. But anyway, that's enough for that. I'm mainly interested in, for you now, the practical side of intellectual or mind health. Number one, I've given this one to you before, I give it again. Practice the habit of gratefulness. I think I mentioned this earlier. It's probably, speaking of pathways in the mind and in the heart, it's probably the one that I'm working on the hardest as a 66-year-old. Why? If I'm repeating myself, forgive me, but as a pastor and as a teacher and as a grandpa and as an older man watching the younger generation, I want to go into lament. You know, I want to complain, and I want to grump, and I want to go on with all of that foolishness. And there might be a time to do that, but I can tell you one thing. Something goes downhill all the way around when that's happening. Practice the habit of gratefulness. It does something. Between head and heart and, I don't know, just life in general, goes better when there's a grateful heart that's being exhibited here in front of a classroom or wherever it may be. And I actually think it's a habit. I actually think it's something that you can actually train yourself to be grateful. Now, I'm just not, I confess anywhere, I am not naturally that way. I tend to, I don't know, well, I don't want to go on about myself, but anyway, it's those kinds of things. Second, exercise and stretch your mental capacity. Work it. I'll reference Sheila first. Do some simple things. Now, there are games of random chance. You're looking at it, I hate games, so I hate them with a passion. I know some people love them. My wife loves them. She loves games, and I don't like them. But we play a few anyway. But here's the thing. I will admit very quickly, or say, some games are helpful. So Sheila actually, you know, she uses, that she has a little tablet that she uses there off and on. And so she if she doesn't know what else to do, she plays Scrabble on there. Well, I'd far rather have her play Scrabble on there and some of those other games where you bop, poo, pow, crash, you know, and do all these kind of other funny things that happen on. It's like, well, so what? But do something that is actually stimulating the brain and is helping you think properly. Play a game of chess. When we first got married, Sheila didn't know how to play chess, so she wanted me to teach her how to play chess, so I did. Then she said, we're going to play until she wins. Well, we played, and I found out that it was not okay just to act like I was trying and not trying, you know, just kind of letting her win. That wasn't okay. Mind you, she finally won a game. The problem is we don't play anymore. Well, exercise and stretch your mental capacity. Back to school teaching, of course, in a more practical way, I say it this way. Be a master of all subjects and be a jack of all subjects and a master of at least one. This is it. Think about this for a minute. The resources in a school, and our schools are always kind of just a little bit limited in a number of ways. But what I have found really, really helpful when I was a principal of a school is I'd try to find out. So here's a first grade teacher who really is interested in auditory learning or something like that. And I would get them a book or so and say, read this book and tell me what you read here. I wasn't twisting her arm or anything like that. Just simply saying, well, if that's your interest, you ought to get good in that area. You ought to just sort of kind of master that so that then you can go to Faith Builders Teachers Week. I don't tell them this, of course, but and there you can pass that information along because there's something you've learned. You've taken it beyond the normal thing. You can't do that with every subject. Nobody can. So exercise yourself across the range of subject matter, but then stretch yourself into areas where you have interest, perhaps, and expand it. Your brain was made to be used. And by now we know. You can study the stuff on dementia and Alzheimer's and things like that. And almost always, the strategies to try to hold that off is to exercise the brain in various ways and make sure that it has some activity going on, that it has to think. Because when it stops, it goes downhill. That's true of anything. Well, let's be sensible then. Keep at it. You're a teacher. Not only do that for yourself, but encourage it in others. This is intellectual health. Oh, and every year, I still do this. Every year, I read at least one or two fairly strenuous academic books that have nothing to do with what I'm teaching this year. I typically read one that does have something to do, so I'm teaching world history, and I maybe read something about a history of Germany or something like that. But then I like to just pick up a book that it fascinates me. It might be on farming, it might be who knows what it may be. I always try to have a book running alongside that I can pick up and read that, sort of leisurely, but it's worth my time to read it, okay? And I would encourage you to do this that type of thing. Here you'll see me referencing the chart on the board again. Remember that you choose inputs. That's where you choose. Which result in outputs. You can't, as my dad used to say, you can't suck blood out of a turnip. Okay, well, so you choose the inputs. And the results, you might choose in a certain sense, but you now have something to actually offer as output. And this is the reason why I get so frustrated with even the modern media stuff everything that goes along with it. I mean, seriously question yourself as a teacher. Where are my inputs? Where are they coming from? What's the source of this stuff? We found out over COVID, maybe this is worth saying here at this point, I actually view my role as a teacher today, one of my primary roles, is to help a student to make sense of all of the information that's out there all over the place, to sort through it and what's true here and what's not true. It's almost the crisis of our generation. So when I first started teaching school, I think I can say with integrity, the problem was not enough information. You had to really work hard to find the information, particularly in-depth information. Now it's overwhelming. Contradictory. This person claims to know, that person claims to know, and so forth and so on. Those are inputs. Think about them and think about where you ought to say no. I think I told you previously that I'm a news junkie. Since I'm a news junkie, only a certain amount of that input is helpful. Once you get beyond, at least for me, once you get past a certain point, you're raffling down through information that just is relatively unimportant. Well, develop that inner sense that says, listen, that's enough. Shut that off. Find it, and then even find good news inputs and so forth. I'm not here to discuss all of that, but really, really, you want to pay attention here. Number four here, before you write me off on it, hear me out on it. You do not have to answer all the questions. Learn to shelve them for future reference. I'm talking about mental health, mind health. Some people get stuck. I've had a few students who get stuck on a question, typically a question of justice. Explain to me how it is, how God can be just, mind you. If what's going on in Ukraine right now, I don't know what the percentage is, but a relatively high percentage of people there, totally innocent, had nothing to do with starting the war. They have nothing to do with trying to keep the war going. Some of them are babies, and a lot of them are certainly under 20 years of age. And can you please help me understand how you could have a just God who allows this type of thing happen? Well, it's a tough question. And I don't have a good, solid answer that answers the whole gamut of the whole range of questions that are associated with it. Do we have the leisure then of just ignoring the question? No, I've learned to shelve it. The key word here is shelve. I even do this with things that bother me at night. I literally, if I get awake at night, and I start thinking about this and that and the other thing. I think in my mind. I literally envision in my mind picking up a book, and on the spine of the book is Problem of Sam. And I walk, and I don't literally do this now, but in my imagination, I walk over and I put it on the shelf. But I mark it with a check mark, an X, a red X, so that I know I need to get that back down. But I don't have to solve that problem. It's 1 o'clock in the middle of the night. How am I going to solve this problem by trying to read through this book, mind you, and get this all figured out in the middle of the night? I can't solve it now anyway. Let me just shelve it. And then I'll get it back down off the shelf. For me, that little mental exercise of actually picking up that piece, that question, or whatever it is that's bothering me and putting it on the shelf, not putting it in a room somewhere, locking the door, and throwing away the key, say, look, I'm never going to think about that again. Not that. That's not a good plan. But learn how to shelve tough things. I can't tell you the number of times that I've had put a question on the shelf. Even as a young man, was out in the field on my father's old farm, all H, disking a field with a 7-foot disc, which they wouldn't dream of doing today. But disking that field with that 7-foot disc, and all of a sudden something would pop into my mind, or a verse or something the preacher had said. That's it. That's the answer to that question. It might not be the full answer, but it's at least a partial answer to it. If I had demanded an answer right to what I was asking it, I don't know where I would have. I'd have just gotten all bogged down in that question. But by letting the thing, just shelving it, it helps to keep your mental faculties healthy and lets them free to do the work you really should be doing anyway, rather than getting stuck. When you get stuck, all your brain power starts. You see that line up there that's a little bigger than, yeah, it's a four-inch conduit. I mean, it runs out so fast you can't fill it up quickly enough, and you start to run out of steam. And the last one I have here is memorize regularly. I'm not trying to be pious here. It has to be one of the better intellectual exercises to keep your mind sharp. And while you're in that exercise, well, you may as well be by adding something up that really is a very, very powerful and eternal and so forth and so on. So again, you're not looking at a person who is a famous or an outstanding memorizer, but I do it regularly. Part of it is for just to keep my mind sharp. A bigger part is, well, I care about the word of the Lord. And if I'm going to exercise in that fashion, why not exercise it there? Rather than, I don't know, trying to memorize some of the other things that might not be all that helpful. So there's just a few things that I've learned over the years for myself that have helped to sustain me over 44 years of teaching school. Some of these practices helping me to keep myself together. Emotional health is next here, and this one, yeah, I think is one teachers need to pay attention to. Well, why? You work with people. You know, now and then I'll get a comment from, I got comments years ago at least from people who would say, well, Brother Melvin, when are you going to get a real job? And with the implication, well, you know, you're just a teacher. I tried not to be reactive to such things, but I would say, well, you know, why don't we just swap out for a day or two? And they'd almost always say, oh, I'm not a teacher. Well, but okay. I don't say it. I don't bother to make the next statement to say, well, then maybe you oughtn't to be so critical of somebody who's trying to. Now, normally they're saying it fun anyway, so I understand that. But in truth, listen, of all the jobs I've ever had in my lifetime, there is nothing as emotional draining as being in front of people every day, 5 days a week, 5-6 hours. You're responsible for them. You're trying to watch 30 students or 20 or 10 or even 5 that you're trying to pay attention to, and they're under your care and under your responsibility. If you've never done it, which I take it most of you have, but those who haven't done it, they don't get it. It draws from you heavily. You need to some inputs here. The first one is practice the habit of rejoicing every day. Philippians says, rejoice always, and again I say rejoice. I make a little difference between this and gratefulness. They're very similar. It's hard to be rejoicing if you're not grateful. But actually, to deliberately rejoice might mean sit down at the piano and play a little piece or sing a song. I don't know what it may mean, but there's an action that I try to attach to rejoicing. There's nothing wrong with shouting out a hallelujah while you're there at home. You can do it in church too if you want to. But I'm just simply saying that the truth is there's this thing called rejoicing. I hate to use the word having fun because it's not quite the same, but it's enjoying the life that you're living and the experiences that you're having and even the challenges that are in front of you. Takes a little bit for me to get there sometimes, but now and then I can rejoice even in the challenge that I'm not really all that happy about in general. So learn to practice that. Invite a confidant and or mentor into your private life to give you advice. This is fascinating. We didn't even know the term mentor when I was growing up. I never heard anybody use it. I don't think I even heard anybody use the word confidant. We knew about friends, good friends that we had, but we didn't know these other terms. These are good things. And I really, really would encourage you there. I was very, 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 very fortunate. So I started teaching in 1978, and John D. Martin was the principal of the school. Anybody who knows John D. knows that John D.'s not shy about anything. And so I learned kind of right from the get-go to talk about life. And I can tell you that Brother John and I have covered almost every subject that can possibly be covered. I know there's more, that's not quite true, but I mean a whole pile of them up one side and down the other about our private lives and all the way from one end to the other. It had to be one of the things that got me a healthy start in the school and as a young man, I'm quite sure it was. I was fortunate. Most people in that era did not have that opportunity. So two things I want to say to you. You should have that, such a thing, and you should be that to some others around you as you gain experience and so forth and so on. What is the genius in the Catholic confessional? I don't think there's any salvation in it at all. But there is something about it that is healthy, and that is that person goes to confessional and sits down there and talks through a screen or however they do, and talks about his personal life, his personal failures, and so forth and so on to that person on the other side of the screen. And in some of these parishes and around the world, well, those Catholic priests were very fine people, and they were friends, and they were able to take them under the wing and help them. So I agree, that's not salvation, but it ministered to those people in some fashion because they had somebody to talk to about their personal lives. You need to have that. And that's what I mean by this. Particularly along the lines the emotional health idea here, I think. Third, I'm back to this point here, identify inputs that fill your emotional reservoir. Be proactive in tapping into those inputs. Just stop for a moment, you might write down there on your paper what they are. Who's a person that you really enjoy being around, and then you feel, when you walk away, maybe you spent the evening with them or whatever, you feel refreshed, you feel encouraged. You feel like, you know what, that was a good time. That's an input. Somebody is they're filling up your emotional tank, so to speak. And you identify who they are or what the situations are that actually create that kind of thing for you and pursue them. I don't naturally do that. I have to sit down and think about it. And some of my friends will now and then tell me, they'll say, well, you know what, you need to get on the phone and call your good friend John D. Martin. You'll feel better about life after that. Well, they're mostly right. So it's that type of thing. Know who those people are and tap in. And again, don't forget to be that for other people. Not only don't forget it, I mean, just actively be that, be the encourager, as the scripture talks about it. And again, I've been very, very fortunate. Very interesting thing. Sheila's mother was non-Mennonite. She grew up non-Mennonite. In fact, in an unchurched family entirely. They didn't attend church. And just one of those stories that actually turns out really, really great. You wouldn't have expected it. Her father was a renegade. Running away, rebel, and they got married, mind you. I think my mother-in-law was 17 and father-in-law was 19 or something like that. They got married and went into 1W service. My father-in-law told me with his own mouth, he said, you know, Melvin, he said, I wasn't married but 6 months, and a tremendous conviction came on me, and I had to say to Peggy, Peggy is my mother-in-law, they're both gone now, but I had to say to Peggy, I'm sorry, Peggy, but I need to go back. I have no alternative. I'm going back to the church. This is remarkable because my mother-in-law looked at him and she said, well, didn't I promise you that wherever you go, I'm going? This is a non-Christian. Long story short, she said, if that's what you're doing, that's what I'm doing. But I'm adding the but now. She brought with her a background that was very different than most of you grew up with. And one of those backgrounds is you say whatever you think. My dear wife has that capacity. You know what? To think about this now, when you run into people with that kind of capacity, they can irritate you deeply or they can help you. And I decided very early in my marriage that, you know what, this lady can help me. Because she might even be wrong, but I will always know exactly what she's thinking and what she feels about this or that or the other thing. And sometimes that wasn't all that much fun, but in general, I began to learn that same habit. Well, if that's what I'm thinking about it, then just say so and be done with it. We can work it out. we've learned by now that once we just get it out there on the floor, we can do something with it. That was a gift that was handed to me from a mother-in-law, first of all. I take it back there, who just had such a capacity, and my wife brought that into our marriage as well. That's an input for me. Identify outputs that empty your emotional reservoir and avoid outputs that drain your reservoir or can potentially drain them. I had a short conversation somewhere here this week, and I'll just offer to you again. Schools do not have the primary responsibility of meeting the emotional needs of, particularly extreme emotional needs, that exhibit themselves in the community. I've seen disaster happen this way. So here's teacher A, teacher B. Teacher A is male, teacher B is female. They are neither of them are married. They're teaching in the same school. And one of them has had a traumatic experience of one form or another, and the other one takes it upon their shoulders to give them counsel. I can tell you this ends up, it just generally does not go a good direction. And I just, it turns out to become an emotional drain. And that's, you want to avoid that like the plague. Now it's not just there, even a student who has extreme needs, you're not hearing me say ignore them, but I'm going to tell you what your first question should be. It still is my question, even as a pastor. My first question when somebody comes to me who is in deep distress is, I ask this to myself, I don't ask it out loud, am I the person, I ask it differently, who is the right person to help in this situation? 9 times out of 10, it's not me. Sometimes it is, and then I take that responsibility. Don't get yourself into draining emotional help situations which are not your responsibility. Direct that, far better to direct that person, be it a student or a fellow teacher or whoever, direct that person to somebody who can actually offer help. Normally, if you're working with somebody every day, whether it's a student or a teacher, this becomes overwhelming. It becomes a nagging drain. Don't do it. Stay away from it. Please hear me right. I did not tell you that you should not be the kind of person that can extend a hand of friendship, that can extend the hand of help, that can listen, actually sit down and listen, and then with some deliberateness, help a person to decide where they might be able to find some help here. I'm all for that. Don't have any issue with that at all. It's when we become the charming prince who comes, I'm talking to the fellows now, who comes dancing into the issue, and we're going to save this thing, is when things go south. And they just go in too often. I'm not saying there's never a good story to be told there. but I know too many of them that go the other direction. So identify outputs that empty, that drain your emotional reservoir, and outputs that, empty or drain. Identify them and learn how to deal with them. Not unkindly, not unjustly, but you need to turn that spigot off and help somebody else to pick that issue up. And I'm saying, even as a 66-year-old pastor, I don't know what the number is or what the percentage is, but I would say a relatively high percentage, 60% or so, of the people who come to me, I very quickly point them to somebody I know who has been through that or knows something about that issue, and say, look, I think you should talk to them. Come back to me after you talk to them and we'll see once what. So that's an idea there. Fifth, identify long-term stressors that rob personal energy. Talk to a confidant mentor about them. The research is pretty clear on this. Some research even demonstrates that short-term stress can be good for you. It pushes you to higher levels of output that sometimes can be very healthy. So please hear me right. You don't try to lead a stress-free. The perfect life is not a stress-free life. Okay, the perfect life, I shouldn't say the perfect life, but when you're living in a broken world, you're bound, you're going to run into some stresses. I had a sister-in-law, 71 years old, not all that old, but fastidious, took care of herself. She was a registered nurse, very just top of the line. Got lung cancer, of all things, and passed away. We buried her just not too long ago. This is a short-term stressor. I'm down talking to my brother, trying to encourage him. I'm doing a few. The stress level just goes up with these kinds of things. You're dealing with cancer and this and that and the other thing. Okay, long-term stressors though are oftentimes relational. They're different kinds of things, and you can't see the end of the tunnel. There seems to be no end to this thing. Well, you want to avoid those or do something to come to terms with them. Again, I would point to that as probably one of the issues that pushed my health down to a level of Crohn's disease and so forth and so on. I'm sure that it had to do with long-term stress. So identify them and try to do something about them and get some help with them, perhaps, is a way to talk about it. More could be said here, but I'm trying to offer you a few things to think about what you can do as a teacher to maintain emotional health. Engagement, but not over-engagement. Inputs, watch the outputs. Keep some margin. Keep some space around your life. And finally, do not make every problem your problem to solve. You know the problem of denominationalism? I get hit up with this all the time. Oh yeah, there's so much disunity in the church and denominationalism, and particularly if you go back to the Reformation and all that. I wrote in my diary one time, you know what, I didn't create this problem. I don't know why I'm trying to solve it. That's a bit unfair, but it's something to be considered. The fact of the matter is not every problem is your problem. It sort of goes along with what I was saying before, and that is, think who or what or where can this problem be solved? If it happens, feel like it has gotten thrown into your lap. And this will help to maintain that sense of emotional health. And now I'm going to end with the easy one. Wealth. Any of you got some wealth you don't know what to do with? I have to tell you a story here. I have a friend, mind you. He went to school here and a number of years ago. And through a series of events, he ended up in New York City with a what's he have there, child care program going on there in New York City. And he bought one apartment, then he bought another apartment. He called me one time and he said, Brother Melvin, do you know anybody that needs some money? Well, I said, yeah, I do. As a matter of fact, of course, it wasn't me, but he said, you know what? The Lord has blessed us here, so here in New York City with our child care program. He said, I got more money than I know what to do with. And I said, well, that's a good problem to have. It's not mine, but that's a good problem to have. I doubt that most of you are in those shoes. I kind of doubt that. I'm not. I'll be very clear with you on that. Try not to brag or complain on this, but you know, I think my first year of teaching in 1978, I think my salary was $10,000. Now, $10,000 in that day was more than what it is today, that's for sure. But I was married, and I had two children, and I don't mind telling you that it was a little nip and tuck to make things work there. So here's a few things Sheila and I learned. Create a budget. You knew I was going to say that. People used to, but listen, people ask Sheila and I, do you have a budget? We'd say, yes, we do. We don't even write it down. You know what it is, right? If you don't have it, you don't spend it. It's that simple. Input must exceed output, period. Okay? Now, once you get that through your head, it's amazing what you can actually make work. And again, hats off to Sheila. She stretched it. You can tell we have fun with this, right? So she can stretch money a mile. And the problem is she's still going to yard sales. And I'm saying, what are you going to yard sale for? I mean, we don't have any children at home, and what do we need? She likes to stop at thrift stores. Actually, I'm just having fun with her because I go along with her periodically, and I like old tools. So I go to these yard sales here, and I try to find an old tool that I can add to my tool chest since I'm a mechanic and so on. I'll get to it here in just a moment. But the second one here is do a reality check. Will it really work? So while I'm saying, well, just make input exceed output, there are realities you have to live with. And when you face those realities, I honestly do not find fault with the young dad. He has three children, he's teaching school, and he realizes, you know what, this salary just is not going to do it. There's nothing wrong with going to a school board chairman, not begging, not complaining, just simply saying, you know what, I don't think I can live on that salary. If you can help, maybe I can continue teaching school. If not, that's okay. But it's better to be clear with the reality check, look, I can't make ends meet here. Than it is to kind of stumble through. The next thing somebody finds out, the credit card bills are way up, and there's a whole lot of other things going on that's going backwards. Don't let that happen. Just don't let it happen. Start talking to somebody long before you run into that kind of a difficulty, if that's the case. Do a reality check. Third, enjoy the challenge of making do. I know it's not always fun, but in a lot of ways, Sheila and I actually, we didn't make it into a game, but we experienced it as a challenge. This is our incomes. This is what we need to do. So my sons and I did combining. My oldest son, since I was a mechanic, we bought two old combines. And if you guys know anything, I think you do know something about combines. So one cost us $3,000 and the other one cost us $5,000. So you have an idea of what kind of combine that was, for sure. But tore them down and put them back together repaired them and, you know, renewed them and all that kind of stuff. And did custom combining in the summers. We have many stories to tell to this day about custom combining in the summers to keep the family finances floating. It was a challenge, but there's a way to enjoy it, and I would encourage you to put your good mind to work, put your good heart to work, and ask yourself the questions, how could we actually make this work? What could we do? Necessity is the mother of invention. I can't help but tell you this story on it. So Sheila and I actually kind of lived within the general parameters, so we're not going to borrow money. Now, we've borrowed a little bit off and on, so I don't want to don't hear it being a hard and fast rule. So we needed a new car. Well, our family was growing, and our little Honda Accord was too small. So we'll start looking for something. So I'm driving home from school in my little Honda and drive into Sunset Auto Sales for you from around Chambersburg and talk to the fellow there. I had $700 in the bank or in my checking account. I talked to the gentleman, and he said, "Well, yeah, this one's $2,500 and this one's $2,800. I don't know what all he was saying. And I said, "Don't you have anything else?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "You know what? There's something just came in here. There's a station wagon back here in the back lot." I went back and looked at it. I said, "Well, how much do you want for it?" $700. I said, "Well, let's go look at it." So we went and looked at it. Well, that thing was rust brown. Now, it didn't have rust on, but it was a color that I knew that Sheila was going to say, "Really?" So I drove it just a little bit, and you know, it drove kind of nice, and I thought, you know what, this might just be the ticket. So I went home and I said to Sheila, "Hey, you know what, I saw a car down there at Sunset, $700. She said, "Really?" I said, "Yeah, let's go see it." So the closer we got, I said, "Now promise me something. You're not going to go ballistic as soon as you see it, right?" Because I'm going to tell you, the color is a problem. We turned the corner to her, and she said, "Oh, no." But remember, this is a challenge, and you enjoy it. I said, "Well, just hold on. Let's get in and take it for a drive." So we got in and took it for a drive. We ended up buying it. And, you know, the funny thing is 5 years later, I got rid of that car. I didn't do anything to that thing. I can't remember I probably did some mechanical work on it. I couldn't believe that thing was still running, and now we graduated to a van. So enjoy the challenge. Trust God, who supplies all our needs. And one story to finish. You remember it says in the Old Testament that just try me. God said, "Just try me out. And see, if you'll just honor me and serve me, and see if I won't open the windows of heaven and just pour out on you more than you could possibly receive." So we did some homeschooling, and our homeschool group is on the way from Chambersburg to Lancaster on a field trip, mind you. There was a couple attending our church. They were from non-Mennonite background. They weren't quite sure what they wanted to do. And Bob, mind you, had borrowed the bus from his old church for us to use to do this trip. Well, we're going down 283, and some of you may know where Kreider's Fertilizer is down along 283 if you happen to be down that way. I know that area. And don't you know, all of a sudden smoke and things began to fly, and parts started to fly out from underneath that bus. And there we were, stuck along 283, the transmission gone. Right over the fence from Kreider's. And so we sat there, didn't know what we were going to do, and decided, well, you know, the thing would go in second gear. No reverse, but it would go in second gear only. So we thought, well, maybe if we could get that thing in second gear, and get everybody on the bus and planned out a route, we could go all the way home. We would just forget the trip, go all the way home in second gear. Well, the driver takes the bus and pulls it up, comes off the exit, comes back and sits at Kreider's. We jumped over the fence. Children got off the bus, and we're there eating our lunch, and we're trying to figure out what we're going to do. And Bob, he's almost in tears. He said, "Melvin, what am I going to do?" He said, "I borrowed that bus from the church I left." I said, "Bob, it'll be okay. I mean, we'll..." In my heart, I was thinking, "God, what are we going to do?" But I said, "It'll be okay." So why don't we pray about it? So we prayed. And I said, "Lord, you know what our needs are." And listen, this is no brag on me. I had less trust than anybody there. But mind you, we went into the office just to make one last call to kind of get our act put together. And I said to the guy behind the desk, I said, "You don't happen to have any transmissions around here for a 5-speed transmissions for an international bus, do you?" He looked at me and he said, "Yeah, we have 10. Yeah, I'll just give them to you." I'm like, "You have 10? Yeah, he said, "See that garage down there? They're all lined up there right in the front of the garage, all 10 of them. They're sitting right there. There are coveralls down there, and there's jacks down there. And you guys mechanics?" "Yeah," we said, "we're mechanics." So I'll give you those things. So we pulled that thing in there an hour later. We went, kept on going on our trip. We had the transmission in. We were all set to go. Trust God. He'll supply all your needs. I know not every story goes that way. I know that. Remember a reality check. But I am here to say, after teaching for 44 years, the Lord has blessed us abundantly. If you were to ask me how in the world we made this work, I always say, I don't know. I have no clue. But I do know that the Lord honors his word. So I'm going to close there. Health, wealth, and reality, wholeness, wholesome living for effective teaching. I know I've given you just a lot of different ideas and gone down a few bunny trails and so on. But just really, really, really want to encourage you to put your trust and confidence in the Lord. Don't forget to pray every day. Isn't that so Sunday schoolish? But don't forget. Actually spend that time just waiting before the Lord, just listening. What do you want of me today? Sometimes for me, it's as short as 5 to 8 minutes. Sometimes it's much longer. Just that simple, but at least stop and wait and listen. What is it that the Lord wants today? And my testimony is, through all the ups and downs and highways and byways that we got ourselves into during those years, the Lord has blessed us mightily, and he'll bless you too. Let's pray. Father, thank you again for your goodness and your grace and just these few little stories that I've told. Lord, you know how weak our faith was. And you know how many times we didn't even bother to ask or to pray. We just stumbled on trying to find our own way. But I do thank you for how in those moments of crises, you honored us, you blessed us. And I know that for this group here seated who have given their lives to teaching school for at least one more year, Lord, I know you'll be gracious to them too. You'll fill them up with the resources that they need to carry out the responsibilities that you've asked them to do. And so I pray that you would move in their hearts and lives, and that schools all over the country would open their doors, bless students, and the kingdom of God would grow. And I pray it in Christ. Amen.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.